This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The controversy over reports of secret CIA prisons and allegations of torture continues to follow Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice on her five-day visit to Europe. Today in Ukraine, Secretary Rice said the U.S. government does not use unlawfully harsh interrogation on American soil or overseas. Earlier, the Bush administration maintained that prohibitions on cruel and inhumane treatment of prisoners did not apply to American personnel overseas. The administration also says that intelligence is critical to the war on terror, that just asking questions isn't likely to get al-Qaeda operatives to tell them about terrorist plots. And while the CIA is the issue at the moment, questions have been raised in the past about techniques used by military intelligence and by police officers. Today we'll talk with two people who have conducted interrogations, one a former military interrogator, the other a police commander, about what their jobs are really like and what's allowed, what works in their experience, and what doesn't. We'll also talk with journalist Mark Bowden about CIA procedures. Later in the program, a radio station run entirely by water power. But first, interrogation. If you've ever conducted interrogations for the police, for the military, for the federal government, give us a call. We also want to hear from those of you who've been on the other side. What was it like? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And we begin with Mike Ritz, a former Army interrogator. Currently, he's a senior instructor at Team Delta, an organization that teaches interrogation techniques. And he joins us now by phone from Worcester, Massachusetts. Nice to have you on the program.
Thanks for having me on, Neil.
We all hear about the horrors, but by most accounts, they represent a tiny fraction of incidents. So take us inside, if you will. I wonder, how critical is the threat of force or the use of it?
Well, our biggest weapon is the fear of the unknown. And that's really what we're going after. And so we're trying to create an environment where the subject wouldn't be quite sure exactly what was going to happen one way or another. And when I say that, I'm not referring to that the subject is necessarily afraid that they're going to be tortured, but there could be a lot of circumstantial fear as well as far as what's going to happen to me. I mean, that really is all the fear and stress you generally need.
Mm-hmm. This is obviously an incredibly stressful situation for the subject in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely. And what we're trying to do as an interrogator is we're trying to become that person that is necessary for the prisoner to talk to us. So on cases that may mean that I'm very nice and I'm incredibly comforting to get the person to relax. And in other cases, it may mean that I have a much rougher demeanor and may scream and yell and actually intimidate to a certain extent that prisoner in front of me.
And how do you decide which technique is appropriate for which subject?
It takes a lot of experience, a lot of know-how, and in my opinion, it takes a lot of instinctual talent. There are people in the business that I've noticed can have a lot of experience and a lot of years under their belt, but if they don't have this sort of innate talent to establish rapport with individuals, to see how another individual ticks, they just won't get it. And we start out by observing the prisoner, and obviously it depends what circumstances we're under as to where we're observing them. Sometimes we may be observing the prisoner and that person's interactions with the other prisoners in the cell block or in mm-hmm. the cage, as we call it, or what have you. Or we may be observing him isolated. We also take account, if we can, of how the person reacted when they were taken into our custody. And that's the beginning process, as well as documenting what the person had on them at the time to see if that gives us any clues to where they were, who they may have been in contact with. It starts before they even get into the interrogation room, I guess is what I'm getting at.
Yeah, and I guess what I'm trying to ask about is you're trying to manipulate them, I guess, psychologically.
Sure. Manipulation always has this negative connotation to it. I like to say persuasion.
Okay.
By all means, we are trying to get this person to cooperate with us in any way that we can do that. And at times, see, what happens is every prisoner really wants to talk. When you're under that much stress, you want to have someone to confide in. And if there's no one around you except for the interrogator, that's the person I want to become as the interrogator. Confess your issues with to me. Sometimes it's easier for people to confess if they can justify it by saying, well, I was really scared in that situation, and so they justify this to themselves, obviously. It's an internal dialogue. And so they confess because, well, I'm scared, so that's my justification for talking. Sometimes it's, well, this guy's just too nice, I have to help him out type of a thing. So it just depends on the situation.
Let's get some listeners involved in the conversation. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org, and we'll begin with John. John calling us from Eureka, California.
Yes. I was interrogated by the FBI. Actually, they didn't take me into a cell or anything, but at length in the early 70s in Isla Vista, where in the context of 3 months of riots, mostly provoked by the police, a bank was burnt down. They found out later that 5 of the people were FBI informants that went inside the bank. So they were interested in political activity, and I was able to really tell them nothing because I never engaged in any of those kinds of things.
But what technique did they use on you?
Intimidation. They were making allegations that people had said things about me, and I was just not, I was very polite with them, but I was not forthcoming, and it never went any further. They were really looking for something pretty hot, but the way I feel about this whole situation, if I may be brief,
sure,
is that this takes us back to Roman law, where you were guilty by accusation. And this is the kind of law that was applied by European kings and by the Inquisition, and it completely overturns the whole English law justice system, and it also sets a standard for other law enforcement people to follow. And I think that has actually happened in the United States, with detainees being put in cells where they didn't have enough covers and interrogated at length, and these are maybe even U.S. citizens.
Mike Ritz, does that, in terms of what the FBI did to John, the caller, does that sound familiar?
Well, sure. Certainly some forms of interrogation, be it circumstantial or actually being somewhat intimidated by the interrogator himself, is a method. Another common practice, and I would guess that he probably experienced this at some point or another, was that the interrogator would be very empathetic to the person's situation, and that's a good way of getting the prisoner to justify his actions by saying, you know, had I been in your shoes, maybe I would have likely have done the same thing. I can understand where you're coming from. You know, you shouldn't be ashamed of it, type of a thing, to try to ease the prisoner's guard. I want to make a point, though. There is a very much a distinction between a law enforcement interrogation and a military interrogation. And in a law enforcement interrogation, the true goal here is to try to get the confession in most cases. If we're talking about an actual interrogation, traditional interrogation setting, they're trying to get a confession and they're trying to get a motive because that will determine the sentencing that comes down later. Whereas in a military interrogation, we're trying to get verifiable intelligence information. I don't really care whether the person in front of me is guilty or not, save only the fact that I can possibly use that person's guilt as an approach to get them to start cooperating with me. But what I'm really looking for is I'm really looking for the big picture, and I'm looking for all of the information, and it needs to be truthful. So to pressure any sort of a false confession, not only does it waste time, but it really jeopardizes everyone's lives in the process if we're in that type of a situation.
May I rejoin this briefly?
Yes.
I think that because of the great amount of power that the interrogator has, and especially in situations where there isn't public a review, that corrupts the whole process. And we know the context of these kinds of things going on in South and Central America, where, for instance, the CIA was present in Santiago, in the stadium, while people were being tortured there and interrogated, and this whole issue has a great context with the Cold War and how we actually lost the moral argument there, and the moral argument is not enjoined here. And I think that military people also have a moral code, and how what we're about is really a moral war. And if we lose the, I'm getting a little bit mixed up, but I'm just saying they have so much power that this is what I think is basically happening, that they're just going berserk. We've seen this happen actually in law enforcement situations. It's also happened in Vietnam.
Yes, I take your point about losing the moral argument. A lot of people would dispute that we lost the moral argument during the Cold War, but I take your point in the current situation.
Well, we did, as far as the people of Chile are concerned, and the people in Argentina, too.
There was a great deal more involved than just Chile and Argentina, but I take your point. Thank you, John, for the call, and let me turn to again to Mike Ritz, and there are differences, again, between the kind of military interrogation that you're talking about and what the CIA does.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm certainly not here to speak as an expert on what the CIA is involved in, but various reports have come out that would sort of hint to that. You're right.
Mm-hmm. The question of power, though, that John raised, well, clearly the interrogator has power.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why it's incredibly important that there is a system of checks and balances. And this isn't just the interrogator. This is prisoner handlers, military police, if you will, or guards.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you look at the Abu Ghraib situation, you know, that was far from actually being any sort of an interrogation process in my mind. That was actually a simple fact of guards getting out of control and nobody paying any attention. And you could trace this back to the Stanford prison experiments with Phil Zimbardo,
mm-hmm.
where he took, you know, regular college students, made half of them prisoners, made half of them prison guards, didn't really give them any particular direction other than that was their roles. And it was very quickly found out that not only were the prisoners becoming submissive and sort of falling into that role, but the guards were also becoming very sadistic, to include some sort of, you know, sexual perversion that they sort of gravitated towards. So, and that's because there was no system of checks and balances. Even Phil Zimbardo himself said that he felt sort of this inclination as the warden of this mock prison to be, you know, with all of that authority to be a little bit sadistic. I think
we'll have to follow up on this after the break. This is NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Today we're talking about interrogation techniques, what's allowed, what works, what crosses the line. Our guest is Mike Ritz, a former Army interrogator who now teaches interrogation training workshops. And joining us now is Neil Nelson, a commander for the St. Paul Police in Minnesota and an interrogation consultant. He's with us from the studios of member station WHA in Madison, Wisconsin. Good of you to be with us today, Commander.
Good afternoon, Neil. Thanks for having me on the program.
As I understand it, you found that using a tape recorder is a very effective tool for interrogating criminal suspects. When did you first start taping your interrogations?
I actually started recording my interrogations from start to finish in the 80s. I was a narcotics investigator, and we were investigating crack houses in St. Paul. And oftentimes these crack houses would contain 15, 18, 20 adults,
mm-hmm.
and we had to decide who was going to go to jail for the couple pieces of crack on the coffee table. And I would interview these individuals, and no matter how well I wrote a report or try to keep track of all the interviews, I couldn't memorialize those interviews or my case very well. So I started recording back in the mid-80s. Then Minnesota had a Supreme Court decision in 1994 that required all custodial interviews in places of detention to be recorded start to finish.
What did you learn, I wonder, when you started playing back those tape recordings to yourself when you were, you know, I guess still writing up reports?
Well, what I thought motivated people to make admissions or confessions, some of the strategies that I had been taught, especially with seasoned criminals, people that have been caught before, didn't seem quite to meet that test or meet that what I had been mm-hmm. previously taught. Then I also found out that my own style, much the way Mike Ritz mentioned that empathy or the understanding or the rapport building had a great deal of impact on the willingness of the individual to share information with me.
So you basically got better by listening to yourself.
I hope much better. Yes.
Now, I wonder, you've been in the business now for quite a while. Has your style changed over the years?
Yes, I probably was a little more, for lack of a better term, in your face, more confrontational in my interview styles, and now I am much more empathetic, rapport building, understanding of the individual's plight and what might have put him in that situation.
I wonder, and I wanted to bring Mike Ritz on this as well, the technique that we see all the time on television, the good cop, bad cop, and I guess some people call it the Mutt and Jeff approach. Do you use that? Do you use that, Neil Nelson?
I can't say I've never used it. You have to understand, for law enforcement in the United States, it all comes down to voluntariness. And if the strategy or technique overwhelms the voluntariness of the individual, obviously it's not a statement we can use. And that's why recording of these statements is built in the public trust, that what happens behind the interview door is there to be reviewed at a future time.
Also useful in court. But Mike Ritz, about that question, is the good cop, bad cop technique used by military interrogators?
Sure, absolutely. And one thing I wanted to add to what Neil said, and I think he'll confirm it, is that there is another big difference, is that if in law enforcement, if you go too strong or too direct with your subject, then he or she is more likely to invoke the Miranda rights and then stay silent on you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's certainly a big difference, because in a military interrogation, that's really not an option. But yeah, sure. And I also would recommend recording all interrogations whenever possible, because it does sort of establish this system of checks and balances. It does allow you to play back what the subject said so that you can analyze their body language, their word choice, eye movement, you name it. So it's certainly a great, great tool.
And also, to some degree, protects the interrogator.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Hmm. Let's get another caller on the line. This is Brian. Brian calling us from Sunnyvale, California.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Just want to point out some of the subtleties and the differences from a civil perspective and also the military, in that when you're following up with interrogation, let's say after a hot pursuit, or you've been in combat with the individual,
mm-hmm.
And you finally get them settled and contained and go into investigation, it's a completely different feel and environment. And so I really have to empathize with the guys in the Middle East who are conducting these type of activities and, trying to keep their head on and not blow their steam.
Was your experience in a police context?
Oh, yes. Many times where, you end up in the booking room with your nose broken or your glasses, smashed into your face, and you're trying to keep this individual under control, and your knees are shaking, your heart's doing 200 beats a minute. It doesn't always work out as people think.
Hmm.
And so you can see a certain amount of aggression and so forth that goes on in the event of, it's a real hot incident and people are in a combat state of frame of mind.
Mm-hmm. Neil Nelson, is that sound right?
I think it does. I think the caller has to understand that beyond our responsibility to get this information is when we ultimately testify to it or try to make the case, we have to appear, we have to demonstrate that we are the impartial gatherers of the facts. So I had the nightmare of having to interrogate the killer of two fellow police officers in St. Paul. And while there was no question my emotions were running high, the need to be able to deal with that person in an unjudgmental fashion, I think, led to the 4 days of interviewing without him invoking his rights and ultimately his conviction. So the caller's right that it's hard, but again, our responsibility is to demonstrate to the public that we are impartial when we gather this information.
Hmm.
Yeah, that's a very good point, and I'm in total alignment with you. The other point I wanted to make was the fact that when you're in more of a cold case situation and you're following up on an investigation where you have maybe circumstantial evidence, interviews, and so forth, and you have the probable cause to pick somebody up, you have a lot more planning and strategy. You have a lot. It comes in a different context altogether, and it seems to be more objective. The other thing that's interesting is when you invoke Miranda, and that is if you pick somebody up at the scene of a crime, let's say for driving under the influence, or you've got a good identification from a robbery, is, you know, to secure the individual, but not necessarily read him his rights and transport him to a location where, number one, everybody is safe and the suspect is away from the victim and so forth. But during that time, from removal from the crime scene all the way to the booking facility, he can speak and talk all he wants if you don't ask any questions. So you can gather a lot of information and not put them into the defensive mode until you're actually in an interrogative environment, and then read them the Miranda rights. And then I also feel, I believe I'm in agreement with the other two on the line, is that I think the more empathetic and kind of searching for the information versus being antagonistic and brutal and threatening has always worked better for me.
Brian, thanks very much.
All right.
Appreciate it. Let's talk now with Bill. Bill calling us from Tempe, Arizona.
Hi.
Hi.
I just want to make the point. I went through the Army Interrogation School in Fort Huachuca, Arizona, in the mid-90s. And when I was being trained there, we didn't spend a whole lot of time on Geneva Conventions. Hardly talked about it at all, actually. They did tell us that we couldn't harm the interrogatee or threaten them with any sort of bodily harm, nor could we, as far as offering them things, we couldn't offer them things that we couldn't actually deliver. That being said, there was a whole lot of wink, wink, nod, nod, and it seemed like they actually kept things intentionally murky.
Mm-hmm. Wink, wink, nod, nod, meaning you can go further than this?
Sort of meaning that use your best judgment, but they didn't actually lay down hard, fast rules for as far as the how we were supposed to interrogate people with what we could or couldn't do.
And presumably in the Army Interrogation School, it's treating you to interrogate prisoners of war.
Exactly.
Yeah. Mike Ritz?
Well, I you know, it's unfortunate that he did walk away with that experience, because I don't feel like that was the case when I went through. And I've since been back and don't feel like that's been the case then either. It's always emphasized. There's a lot of wink, wink, nudge, nudge in the interrogation business, because there's a lot of different approaches and things that are used. But as far as any sort of physical techniques, I never ever had the impression that anything physical whatsoever would be acceptable. In fact, it's very much emphasized that should you lay your finger on your prisoner, then you may indeed yourself find that you become a prisoner. So because if something happens and that prisoner leaves that interrogation room and someone, a medical personnel or otherwise, American Red Cross or someone else, speaks with that prisoner, and that prisoner says, I received these injuries here, 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 and can point them out, well, you can bet the investigation is going to start immediately. Now,
certainly that's true, but as far as the threat or threatening a prisoner with some sort of physical harm, that's what was sort of winked at, and we used to have a joke about it. We sometimes would joke saying, you could find yourself with your head cut off tomorrow, and then adding, it could happen, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it was sort of a joke with some of us.
But, Bill, didn't they also teach you to never make any threat that you couldn't actually carry out?
They said that, yeah, but there was also, like I said, a bit of wink, wink that went along with it.
Hmm. In the police context, Neil Nelson, are you allowed to make promises you don't intend to keep? Are you allowed to lie? Are you allowed to do that sort of deception?
There's some deception allowed, and I, unfortunately, each state is different, so I can't
generalize.
In the state of Minnesota, for example, you can use deceit, but only to the point that it would not make an innocent person lean toward confession. So in other words, the suggestion that I suppose you could suggest evidence exists, but if you say this is a videotape of you committing the crime, this is your fingerprint from in the crime scene, that would probably be outside the deception range in Minnesota. Other states, it is allowed. And again, Neil, with the recording requirement, at least in Minnesota and now in Wisconsin, that's what I'm doing here today, it's there for public scrutiny. It's there for the public to decide what is acceptable technique for police. And I think that's what's important as the judges look at these techniques and listen to the deception. If it's outside of what the public feels law enforcement should be doing to get these statements, I would think the courts will step in and control us even more.
Bill, thanks very much for the call.
Thanks.
And Neil Nelson, we're going to let you get back to work. We appreciate you taking your time out of your busy day there in Madison to join us.
It's been a pleasure.
Neil Nelson is a commander for the St. Paul Police and an interrogations consultant. He was with us from the studios of member station WHA in Madison, Wisconsin. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's see if we can get another caller on the line. This is James. James is with us from Little Rock, Arkansas.
Yes, sir. Thank you for having me on the show. I appreciate
sure.
it.
Go ahead.
My situation has to do with being in the military and accused of a crime and dealing with CID interrogation.
That's criminal investigations?
That's correct.
Uh-huh. And what was that like?
I was accused of theft from the PX.
Mm-hmm.
A PX is an Aces. Are you familiar with that?
No, go ahead.
Okay. It's a store. They have
a PX. I know. The
contract.
The post exchange. Yeah, sure.
All right. So my situation was, I guess this took place in Taji, Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
I was suffering from PTSD at the time.
A post-traumatic stress syndrome.
That's correct. April 24th of 2004, we lost about five of our guys, and I worked on three, and all three died.
Mm.
Anyway, because of that, I started doing things like collecting items. It was obsessive compulsive disorder exacerbated by PTSD.
Yes.
And you know, one of the things was I bought an entire pallet full of Gatorade and put it in my room. And so, you know, these were odd things to be doing.
Yes, I can understand.
Anyway, I also bought a bunch of flashlights, batteries to go with them, and knives.
Yeah, so...
During a room search one time, they decided that this was odd and needed to confiscate it and have me interrogated the next morning.
Mm-hmm. And what was the interrogation like?
The interrogation, they seemed pretty coordinated. They seemed to me like they had a plan. But, you know, I entered the room. They said to my first sergeant that, oh, we have you and, or we have him and you can go now. Never told me I could leave. They informed me of my rights, which I cooperated because I wanted to participate, and took away my weapon. In the military, if you're in a combat zone and somebody takes away your weapon, you're not allowed to leave
because mm-hmm.
you got to have your weapon wherever you go. Anyway, I told them, you know, they what I was doing, I was collecting things, and you know, I can't explain why. But anyway, you know, they went into talking about, you know, my PTSD and all the situations that went on.
Mm-hmm.
The
did you feel like you were browbeaten? Did you feel like...
Absolutely. They said knee to knee. Two guys, one was named Bucci, and the other guy, I forgot what his name was. They said knee to knee to me. And we're just badgering, yelling and screaming and telling me that, you know, you're not going to see your family for 20 years because this is what the offense is. You know, you're going to go to jail in Kuwait and you won't even come back to the States for years and years.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was crying and crying and my stomach acids were getting out of control. They took me to the hospital and got me some treatment and then brought me back to the interrogation room. And then they wrote down a couple of things on the paper. You know, I never touched anything, any papers. But they wrote it down and they said, okay, if you admit to this and this, we'll have your sentence reduced. And we can move on and get this over with. And it's going to be no big deal. And, you know, I almost thought about it and because I was so upset. And, you know, I just wanted to get it over with. But I looked at the paper and, you know, the things that they wrote down were completely false. So I refused to sign the paper.
And did it eventually go away?
No. They took the paper and sent it to the prosecution. The prosecution went ahead and charged me with what was written down on the paper, and I never wrote it and never signed it. And even though I never signed it and even never even touched the paper, they went ahead with the prosecution. And so,
James, I'm afraid we're out of time in the segment. Hold on, we'll get back to you, okay?
Okay.
This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the American Public Transportation Association, providing transportation designed to help older Americans lead healthy, active lives at publictransportation.org. From Elizabeth Arden and Allergan Dermatology, makers of Provage anti-aging treatment with Ida Benone at provageskin.com/radio. And from Raymond James, independent financial planning advice, asset management, and investment banking. Individual solutions from independent advisors. RaymondJames.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing interrogation techniques today, how to get information from detainees and prisoners without resorting to torture. Our guest is Mark Ritz, former Army interrogator. He's with us by phone from Worcester, Massachusetts. Just before the break, we had James on the line. James telling us a story about how he was interrogated by Army criminal investigators accused of stealing some supplies from the PX. In fact, he says he was suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder and was collecting things and was browbeaten. And James, I just want to find out before we let you go about how the case turned out.
The case, I ended up taking a Chapter 10 and just getting out. But it gave me, other than honorable discharge, and it has pretty much ruined my life.
Mm-hmm. And you feel that this was all the result of this essentially misunderstanding and over-aggression by these interrogators?
Absolutely, sir. Absolutely. They didn't use any recording devices. But, they had digital cameras and high-tech listening devices sitting down in the office. They had laptops everywhere. And I'm wondering, why can't we make interrogators use recording devices to protect them and the interrogatee?
I think that's a point that Neil Nelson there in St. Paul would agree with you on. James, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you, sir. I really appreciate it.
I appreciate it. And Mike Ritz, I just wanted to say, are interrogation techniques for CID the same ones that you learned at in the Army?
There are going to be many similarities to the process, sure, but obviously it's a whole different set of circumstances. I wouldn't be opposed whatsoever that all interrogations be recorded. I think it would be a very positive thing, and I can't think of any particular downside to that.
Joining us now is Michael Hirsch, a senior editor for Newsweek magazine, and he's been covering the controversy over interrogation practices since Abu Ghraib, and he joins us now by phone from Arlington, Virginia. Michael, nice to have you back on the program.
Thanks for having me, Neil.
And what we wanted to talk about was the techniques we've been talking about, the distinction between police and military. In terms of the CIA, I guess it's a little difficult to know what they do based on the nature of the organization.
Very difficult. Unlike the Army and the police, the CIA never really had much of an institutionalized history of interrogations. I mean, they were relatively new to the game. In fact, one of the complaints that the FBI had after 9/11, when effectively there was a handoff of this role from the FBI, which was focused on law enforcement, to the CIA, which was more engaged in war on terror as a war, was that the CIA didn't know what it was doing. The FBI had a whole bunch of techniques, which mostly involved far more carrots than sticks, and the CIA basically had to go to the Justice Department and ask what it was allowed to do.
Mm-hmm. And in terms, the origin indeed of some of the controversial memos that came out of the Bush administration.
Exactly. In fact, really the single most controversial memo, the so-called torture memo, that came out in 2002 was to a very great extent a response to questions from the CIA about what kind of techniques it could use with a specific prisoner, Abu Zubaydah, an al-Qaeda lieutenant who had been captured and who was resisting traditional questioning techniques.
Mm-hmm. And, Mike, one of the things I know you've been reporting on for some time is this idea that techniques used by the CIA, particularly in Afghanistan, tended to then to, transmit to...
Migrate.
Migrate to Army interrogators. And Mike Ritz, I wanted to ask you about that.
Well, I think that could very likely be the case, but I think the New York Times also reported, which I think is more likely to be the case, that this is actually a result of immature interrogators and intelligence officers encountering the survival evasion resistance escape training and not quite comprehending the fact that that is for the purpose of teaching resistance and not for the purpose of teaching interrogation.
Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, when one group of interrogators sees other groups of interrogators using different techniques, might they borrow those techniques?
Well, I mean, it should be clearly outlined by the leadership what you're able to do and what you're not able to do. And again, we have to go back to that checks and balances. And if putting a recorder in the interrogation booth is going to sort of oversee and monitor that, then I'm all for it.
Mike Hirsch, in terms of some of the more controversial techniques that we've heard about the CIA, I guess sleep deprivation, waterboarding, and that's where a prisoner is dunked underwater and I guess can understandably come away with the impression that they're about to be drowned.
Well, actually, a person is placed on a board face up and a cloth is wet, is dampened with water, continually dampened with water, and the person is... gets the sensation of drowning. That's the most common waterboarding type technique I've heard. I just wanted to add that as far as the SEER training that the other caller referred to, this was it was more than simply something someone misunderstanding that this was survival training. This was actually consciously adapted to come up with tougher interrogation techniques, and that was used as a kind of threshold. In order to determine what might be allowable. In other words, if our special forces guys could endure this type of training, then perhaps some of these techniques might be used against detainees.
I see. Mike Ritz, I wanted to ask you also, the techniques like that, waterboarding, sleep deprivation, are those allowed under the Army Field Manual?
Well, the sleep deprivation becomes kind of a gray area. The waterboarding, I would think, wouldn't be condoned whatsoever, and since I started Team Delta, over the years, it's almost become a stress laboratory, and it's given me the ability to try techniques that I wouldn't have otherwise been able to do, which included waterboarding. I had willing participants going through this training, well aware of the fact that these things might occur. And even though there's no lasting marks or injuries should you do it properly, sheer fear and trauma that occurs during a waterboarding session, I would say, would constitute as torture.
And would you fear that any information that you received under such a technique might be, the subject's going to tell you anything that you want to hear in order to make this stop?
Well, yes, but if the interrogator is asking questions appropriately and not leading that source down that road of what he would like to hear or the information he would like to obtain, then they may be able to do it with some sort of effectiveness, but most likely it's going to be unreliable.
Mm-hmm. Mike Ritz, thank you so much for being with us today. We appreciate your time.
Thanks.
Mike Ritz is a former Army interrogator and a senior interrogation constructor at Team Delta, which is an independent organization of former military personnel that conducts training workshops. He joined us by phone from Worcester, Massachusetts. And Mike Hirsch, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Neil.
Mike Hirsch of Newsweek magazine joined us by phone from Virginia. When we come back, we'll be talking about a radio station that operates under its own damn power.